Today, why did the entire cabinet of the Dutch government step down in January? And will it have any effect on this week's general election?
The Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, is on his bike. He's cycling out of the Binnenhof, which is the Prime Minister's office in the centre of The Hague. Cycling through town, he's in a long black raincoat and his customary glasses. He's completely surrounded by cameramen and reporters and journalists. He cycles a short way through town, turns in through the very imposing gates of the Royal Palace, cycles up this long alleyway to the very ornate royal palace where the king lives. He walks up the red carpet, up the stairs to the sort of very imposing big front doors of the palace. He walks through, the doors shut behind him, and he is off to see the king. And the reason he's doing all this is because he is handing in his and his cabinet's resignation.
The scene that The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley is describing earlier in the year kickstarted an election campaign in the Netherlands like no other. First, there was the scandal that led the government to resign, involving thousands of people, many of them ethnic minorities, being wrongly accused of cheating the benefit system. And then there were overnight curfews and other tough COVID restrictions that sparked widespread public disorder. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in focus, a disgraced government and COVID riots. But are the Dutch voters ready to give their Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, another chance? John, I hope it's okay to say that it is so Dutch for the Prime Minister to deliver a resignation by bike, which might seem low-key, but as you said, this was the entire Netherlands cabinet stepping down. That is pretty dramatic. What had happened?
What had happened? Well, this happened in January the 15th. The entire cabinet had resigned.
De rechtsstaat moet burgers beschermen
en masse, tegen een in disgrace, almachtige overheid. Over a child benefits scandal. Essentially what happened was that the Dutch tax office had treated more than 20,000 Dutch families appallingly by wrongly accusing them of claiming child benefits fraudulently. Now, Rutte, he went in to tender his resignation. We should say, I think, that he's stayed on and the cabinet has stayed on in a caretaker capacity since then. Because
that type of resignation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is a step that they would have had to have taken anyway a few weeks later, because voting in Dutch elections starts today. It's customary in Dutch politics for the government of the day to step aside about a month or so before new elections are due. And they're only allowed to carry out kind of a very limited legislative program. But it was a big deal. You know, Rutte admitted that big mistakes have been made. He said innocent people have been criminalized, lives have been ruined. The buck does stop here. The government wasn't up to standard throughout the whole affair. Mistakes were made at every level of the state. And he said that terrible injustice was done to thousands of parents.
We felt the need to step down because of the extreme seriousness of the report by the parliamentary committee, which has studied thoroughly and in-depth what happened. We came to the conclusion that it's unavoidable that we step down.
It really came to a head with a very damning parliamentary report that was called Unprecedented Injustice. And that was published in December. And what it basically revealed was that as many as 26,000 parents had been essentially wrongly accused of defrauding the benefits system, dating back to about 2012. There were really awful cases, very simple mistakes such as leaving a signature off a form. Things like that, you know, led to parents getting these demands for literally tens of thousands of euros in child benefit that had to be repaid immediately. And, you know, they were taken to court. They were denied a right to appeal. There were cases of unemployment. People went bankrupt. There were divorces. Families split up. They had to move home and sell the family home. I mean, it was disastrous for, you know, several thousand families.
It was terrible because at a certain point, you can't pay any bills. You can't afford anything. You get a wage seizure. Your allowances are withheld. I received a bank seizure. I couldn't go shopping or pay for everyday expenses and got into even more debt.
The government's apologized for the tax office's methods, this completely kind of unnuanced system, this kind of mass surveillance system, and it set aside more than half a billion euros, 500 million euros in compensation, which that comes down to about 30,000 euros for each family.
It sounds terrible. And am I right in thinking there was a racial element to it too?
There was. I mean, this really aggravated it because at least 11,000 of those 26,000 parents were basically singled out by the tax office for sort of special scrutiny simply because their name didn't look Dutch. So there's one lawyer who represented the families, was very completely blunt about it, said they were basically picked out as a result of ethnic profiling by bureaucrats who picked out their foreign-looking names.
That is quite something.
It was quite something. And you know, the parliamentarian's report was absolutely brutal about it.
Did they actually get to the nub of the problem? Like, what had gone wrong? How did kind of Dutch authorities start essentially racially profiling people and then accusing them of fraud?
It was a system that was put in place, and it was clearly a system that wasn't subtle enough, wasn't specific enough, didn't take into account individual circumstances, most awfully of all, didn't allow people to appeal or kind of protest their innocence. It just essentially steamrolled them. One of the reasons that it didn't provoke such huge public outrage as it might otherwise have done, is because it all started under the previous cabinet. So Rutte has been in charge now of three coalition governments in the Netherlands. The previous one was a kind of a grand coalition with the Dutch Labour Party, the main kind of centre-left party. And it so happens that the minister who was in charge of the whole benefits system, social affairs minister, was from the Labour Party. But it isn't part of the current coalition. It's in opposition. What's more, the Labour Party leader is this same guy, Lodewijk Asscher, and he resigned.
Op een andere manier.
Literally a few hours before the cabinet stepped down. So that's partly what allowed the government to take this step. It's a very smart move by Rutte, given that he was going to have to step aside anyway. He could, in effect, sort of take political responsibility, get the kudos for sort of putting his hands up and saying, yeah, okay, you know, things went wrong. But he's been able to say, you know, blame the whole system, blame the opposition, say the whole system needs reform. So in a way, he's kind of taken political responsibility without any actual political cost whatsoever.
Oh, to be a political reporter in the Netherlands right now, this is quite a story. And okay, so I can tell where we're going then, which is that once the entire government had resigned, perhaps the political impact on Mark Rutte's ruling party wasn't that big.
I mean, he hasn't had a completely free ride. Some of the parents involved are understandably extremely bitter about it. And he's been confronted in TV debates in the run-up to the election by furious parents saying things like, you know, you've completely failed me. But, you know, it's basically been water off a duck's back.
Okay, so he's managed to escape this benefits scandal without too much damage to himself. But what about the coronavirus crisis? How has he handled that?
He's handled the beginning part of the COVID crisis pretty well. Like many political leaders across Europe, he got a big boost sort of this time last year, that where there was a kind of a rally around the flag effect. He got a 5 or 6 point boost in the polls, which he's held on to. And, you know, there was a sense of the country kind of pulling together behind this leader who was anyway very popular. The Dutch opted for what they called a smart or a sort of intelligent lockdown. They locked down early, they locked down in time. It was quite effective. Schools, universities, bars, restaurants, they all shut. But kind of most non-essential shops stayed open. And Rutte said, we're going to tackle this intelligently. I'm going to trust people to obey the rules. And the Dutch had, you know, comparatively speaking, a far less severe first wave. It all started to go a bit pear-shaped in the Netherlands in October, November. The second wave really kicked in. And for a while, the Dutch infection rate was really among the highest in Europe. Rutte really had to step in and clamp down hard, which is what he did.
En daarom gaat Nederland
voor een periode van in ieder geval 5 weken in lockdown.
It was a very, very strict lockdown. Bars and restaurants were shut down as early as October, and schools and non-essential shops were closed from mid-December. That still wasn't being as effective as was hoped. And so then, at the end of January, the government brought in a nighttime curfew. First curfew in the Netherlands since the Second World War. Wasn't very popular. Anyone who was caught violating it faced a fine of nearly €100.
And that was such a handbrake turn for the Netherlands. It caused a hell of a reaction, didn't it?
Yeah, there were protests. They weren't big protests. They were quite spectacular ones, quite violent. They involved, you know, sort of police using water cannon and stone throwing by youths. There were 3 nights of rioting, and about 400 people in all were arrested in several Dutch towns and cities. You know, it was described as the worst rioting in the Netherlands for decades. Some of them started as kind of genuine protests against the curfew and against lockdown. They also involved sort of COVID deniers, conspiracy theorists, that kind of thing. But they were essentially hijacked, and some of them were actually started by youths really out just kind of looking for trouble. Rutte said that these had nothing to do with genuine protesting, it was just criminal violence and that's how we'll treat it. Although there have been sporadic incidents since, there have been a few attacks on coronavirus testing centres and this sort of thing. This wasn't kind of civilizational unrest.
Is the end of this tough lockdown in sight in the Netherlands?
Not quite yet. The curfew was extended until today, 15th of March, which oddly enough is the day that voting starts in this 3-day election, and polls in the Netherlands stay open till 9 p.m.
That was handy.
This all happened a couple of weeks ago. Rutte said he made one of his public announcements. He said that the Netherlands was in an incredibly difficult phase, but we are at a time where we need to be prepared to take a little bit more risk. Clearly, he felt that he needed to make some kind of gesture. And, you know, that the Dutch were, as in many countries, were getting really weary of lockdown. The elections were, you know, a matter of days away. And so he said, for example, that, you know, secondary schools have now reopened for at least 1 day a week. People can go to non-essential shops now, providing they make an appointment. But, you know, bars and restaurants remain shut. So it's really kind of fiddling around the edges in an attempt to give people the impression that there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And obviously, I imagine to encourage them to put their ballot in the right box.
Has the vaccine arrived?
Vaccines have arrived. That's another peculiar thing. The Dutch vaccine program got off to the slowest start in Europe. Government has admitted that it wasn't ready logistically. But once again, the Dutch don't seem to be that unhappy about it, and it's certainly not playing into the election or the campaign at all at the moment.
Wow, so despite a difficult second wave in terms of COVID, a very stringent lockdown, including overnight curfews, and a very slow start to the vaccine programmes, Rutte has gained politically over the COVID period.
Well, I don't know whether he's gained, but he certainly hasn't lost. I mean, he's hung on to his popularity. That is clearly because some remnant of this sort of rally round the flag effect, but also just COVID has just kind of sucked the life out of politics.
I mean, it does sound quite bizarre that just in January, Rutte and his entire government resigned in disgrace over a terrible scandal. But today, they're entering an election in what looks like to be a very strong position. And as we know, he's now one of Europe's longest serving leaders. Do we know why he's been so successful?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, he is a very interesting guy, Rutte. He comes from a family that at the time was living in Indonesia, which was a Dutch colony. Father was interned in a Japanese POW camp. His mother didn't survive that experience. And the whole family was chased out of Indonesia by a sort of a wave of anti-Dutch sentiment. After the war, they had to kind of rebuild everything from scratch. He's actually much younger, a few decades younger than his 3 siblings. What seems to have been the sort of transformative moment in his life was that his elder brother died of AIDS. when Rutte was still quite a young man. And Rutte, on several occasions since then, has said that that was his sort of light bulb moment, and it made him realize that you only get one life, basically, and you really have to do with it what you want to do with it.
So much tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, a family of with a lot of tragedy. So he went into student politics. He was quite a star in student politics. 2002, he was appointed a junior minister in this VVD party for social affairs, employment. And 4 years later, he became the party leader. And 4 years after that, in 2010, he was prime minister. Quite a meteoric political rise. But he's a very weird combination, really. He's quite combative. He can lose his temper very easily. He has this very brisk, kind of corporate, efficient manner. He worked for some time for Unilever, but he combines that with a real, what used to be called the common touch. He connects with people, but he's not married. As far as anyone knows, he's never been in a relationship.
Never.
He says he simply doesn't have time. He still lives in the same part of The Hague where he grew up. He bikes everywhere. I mean, there's a very famous incident a few years ago now where he was walking into his office in the sort of Dutch parliament government buildings and he spilt his coffee. And there were cleaners around. And he insisted on cleaning up the coffee for himself. He said, no, I've spilt this. This was my mistake. You shouldn't be having to do extra work because of me. And he got this kind of round of applause from the cleaners, you know.
And what is he like as a political operator now as the leader of the centre-right VVD party?
But politically, he's a very, very, very savvy political operator. I mean, he's headed three coalitions of wildly, wildly different political complexions. The political landscape in the Netherlands is so fragmented that the only way to govern is through alliances, some of which sometimes will be unlikely.
How fragmented? How many parties are there?
Massively fragmented. There are a record 37 different parties standing in these elections. Right? It's really the most. Dutch politics was already fragmented, and it led to political scientists use this term now, Dutchification, for the kind of complete splintering of the political language. So you've got this massive rise in the number of small parties, and that's obviously been stimulated by and has become possible because the Dutch actually have probably the sort of the purest proportional representation system in Europe. The whole country is one constituency. There are 150 seats in the parliament. And so mathematically, that means that as a party, if you win just 0.67% of the national vote, you get a seat in parliament.
And so along with Rutte's party, you have the Christian Democrats, Labour, the Greens, pretty familiar sounding parties. But what about the rest of this huge political menu facing Dutch voters this week? Who else is there?
There is also standing in these elections a party for animal rights. There's a party for pensioners, a party for the over 50s. There's a party called Think. There's a pirate party standing this year.
It's like the Monster Raving Loony Party.
Yeah, no, the pirate party is an existing. I mean, it exists in Scandinavia and in Germany. It's quite a European thing. But there's a Dutch version of the pirate party. They're largely about kind of data abuse and internet freedom and that kind
piracy.
Of thing. Yeah. I just saw one of their election posters the other day, and it's a fantastically brilliantly blunt Dutch election slogan: "We'll fix this shit." And then there's equally a joke party that's just that's called legitimately enough in English the Party Party.
And, what happens if they get in?
Well, Lord knows. And last time, this was the one that absolutely cracked me up in 2017. There was even a party called the Niet Stemmers, which means literally the non-voters, and that was a party aimed at voters who said they thought they would probably abstain, and it promised. It promised in its manifesto that if it got any MPs, they wouldn't vote in Parliament either.
No shortage of novelty parties then. But what about the traditional left? Why are they not providing a serious challenge to Mark Rutte's chances of forming the next government?
Well, the left are suffering from the fact that, like in many European countries, they were in coalition or in power in the aftermath of the financial and economic crisis. So they found themselves in a position of having to implement really tough austerity policies, and that annoyed an awful lot of left-wing voters. So they did really, really badly in 2017. The Dutch Labour Party lost 3/4 of its seats. But it's also suffering from the fact a bit that there is a, you know, as this fragmentation of the political landscape has happened, so naturally enough has the fragmentation on the left. So you've 3 or 4 different left-leaning parties sort of vying for voters.
And what about the far right? Clearly, they still have a presence in Dutch politics, and much of the focus ends up on Geert Wilders.
So, yeah, he's obviously interesting. He was once actually an MP in Rutte's party, the VVD, and he founded his own party in 2006. It's defined, it's not really... It is a far-right party, but the way it's really defined is anti-Islam. It's not a normal party at all. He's its only actual member. And if you look at its manifesto this year, he says he wants to, what he calls, de-Islamize the Netherlands. He wants to close borders. He wants to end refugee permits for Syrians. Although he is, on paper, the second biggest party, he'll probably end up with around 20 seats in parliament, somewhere between 12 and 14% of the national vote. And most significantly, obviously, Rutte, and indeed pretty much every other party leader in the Netherlands, has said that they won't work with him. So there's, you know, it's impossible, pretty much impossible to see him ending up actually in government. It's interesting that he's not advanced much since last time. It's a picture that we've seen also in other European countries, again, partly related to the pandemic, which is simply that if you look at this sort of Salvini in Italy and Le Pen in France, AfD in Germany, they've had the wind taken out of their sails a bit by the pandemic. They haven't really had anything to campaign on. And of course, the really big issues that really had traction for them in the elections of 2015 and 2016 and 2017, which is particularly immigration, that issue has simply kind of fallen off the agenda.
Coming up, when will we know who will form the next Dutch government? Okay, so unusually this week, there will be 3 days of voting because of the pandemic instead of one. How soon will we know who makes up the next government? And how will the coalition be put together?
So the average length of time that it takes to form a coalition in the Netherlands is 72 days. You need to piece together a coalition cabinet that has 76 seats in parliament. It can take a lot longer. Last time it took 208 days without a government, and it was a record. But I mean, it's very unlikely, I think, that it'll take that long this time. Rutte this time is expected to do better than he did in 2017 in terms of seats, and he should be able to negotiate a coalition very similar to the current one in a lot less time.
Wow, so after everything that's happened, the story in the Netherlands this week and in the coming weeks might be more of the same. That means Rutte carries on as prime minister for even longer. What is the eventual aim for him? Does he just want to carry on and carry on?
I think he does. I think he has politics is clearly pretty much his life. He's clearly good at it. He's clearly popular for the time being in the Netherlands, and I don't think he has any intention of stepping aside at the moment, certainly.
John Henley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was John Henley, our Europe correspondent, and you can follow all his coverage of the Dutch election results and the formation of the next government in the coming days and possibly weeks ahead. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.